1, 2, 3.
Welcome to In the Studio with a 21st century perspective on history's greatest rock albums. I'm Redbeard, and today in the studio, it's the anniversary of the album which has sold more than 10 million copies in the U.S. while igniting the 80s pop metal movement.
About halfway through the Pyromania album, I first noticed that it was getting difficult to create something that was as good as the top-notch artists. We weren't that little band from Sheffield anymore. You have to forsake a lot of things.
You know, your social life goes out the window totally. Girlfriends and just stuff like that, that are just regular standard things, become really difficult to keep up. Welcome back to In the Studio. I'm Phil Collin of Def Leppard.
Hi, this is Joe Elliott.
And Rick Savage, and we're from Def Leppard, and we're in the studio
for Pyromania.
As the 1980s began, there was something of a hard rock revival going on in the UK. A whole generation of young bands who had never really bought into the punk rock movement or the new wave of dance music that followed. Instead, they listened to such pioneering heavy rockers as Deep Purple and Thin Lizzy, plus glam rockers Mott the Hoople, T-Rex, and Roxy Music. The biggest stars to emerge from this British hard rock resurgence were five teenagers from the northern industrial town of Sheffield who called themselves Def Leppard. What set them apart was their ability to translate their heavy metal roots into hook-laden pop songs. It was a marriage that made their third album, Pyromania, released in February 1983, one of the biggest-selling albums of the 80s, and, according to the AllMusic guide Steve Huey, quote, the catalyst for the 80s pop metal movement. Def Leppard's songs on Pyromania weren't raw or spontaneous in sound, but the performances were still energetic and committed. Leppard's quest for huge, transcendent hard rock perfection on Pyromania was surprisingly successful. Their reach never exceeded their grasp, which makes the album an enduring and massively influential classic, end quote. I asked Def Leppard lead singer Joe Elliott about growing up in Sheffield and the music that influenced him as a boy.
Where I actually grew up, all the neighborhood kids were about 15 years old when I was like 9 or 10.
So you hung out with
people. So when I was like 9, I was listening to Aqualung by Jethro Tull, Court of the Crimson King by King Crimson.
At 9?
Yeah, Thick as a Brick, all that kind of stuff, as well as Rod Stewart, you know, like Every Picture Tells a Story, what I mean.
Oh, yeah.
But then when I started to try and develop my own kind of pop tastes as well, I mean, I did like those, but I had no option but to, because that's what they were all listening to. The first thing that really blew me away completely was T-Rex with his song called Get It On.
No kidding.
I saw them on Top of the Pops and I saw Mark Bolan and he had all this long curly hair, women's shoes on, believe it or not, and like all these scarves and velvet trousers. I mean, looking back now, I looked a right idiot, but I just looked at him and I thought, wow, what a guy. I want to be him. And then it was about a year after that I got into Mott the Hoople big time.
Oh, Mott, yes.
And ever since, I've, like, Ian Hunter's been my all-time hero.
Yeah. singer Joe Elliott's love affair with rock and roll started early and never waned. Here's Joe with Def Leppard guitarist Phil Collin in the studio.
I was just one of them kids that you used to get the school reports that said, does have the intelligence but lacks the effort. You know, I just couldn't be bothered. I always knew I'd be okay. I took my exams. I didn't swap for them. I passed them. My mind really was elsewhere. I was either going to be a rock and roller or a footballer.
A soccer player.
Yeah.
Rock and roll or a football player. So that was really a big
part. I actually told my careers teacher that.
Did you really?
Yeah.
They laughed at me when I said I was going to be a guitarist. They said, I don't think you're going to be able to do that. Perhaps you work in a guitar factory or something.
Oh, guitar factory?
Yeah. I said, no, you don't understand. I want to play it. And they said,
yeah, right.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you've got to take into consideration, they have to think like that, because 99.9% of the kids at school don't end up doing what we're doing.
Oh, absolutely.
Which is fact, you know.
Absolutely.
But there's always the one little sticking point, like me and Phil, that's going to turn around and say, well, you're wrong, pal. You know, and, you know, we were lucky to get kind of break out and get away with it. You know, we had the courage of our convictions at least.
I'm
Def Leppard was founded in 1977 by guitarist Pete Willis and bass player Rick Sav Savage. They soon added another Sheffield schoolmate, guitarist Steve Clark, and eventually 15-year-old drummer Rick Allen. Joe Elliott didn't join the band until a year later in 78. At age 17, Joe Elliott was working in a steel tool factory where he wrote songs in the basement on his lunch break.
They kicked me out for playing cricket down in the basement.
For playing cricket in the basement of the factory?
With a Bakelite knob, which is like a very heavy, like a top of a gear stick. It went through a window. They went too impressed.
And so that was the end of your career at Osborne?
Well, they didn't fire me. They just came down and said, there's opportunities for you to kind of leave. I think you should take them. So I did. They handed me 500 quid, which paid off my part of the PA that
we
had.
How much is that in?
And
I
got a job, $800 maybe.
Yeah, they gave you about $800.
And that was a Friday. And then the following Tuesday, I got a job as a van driver, which also came in very, very handy because I could take the van home at night.
Yeah, I progressed to a van driver for the next job I had after the burglar alarm factory. And I was driving motorcycles around London, delivering things.
But the vans came in handy because when you're in a band, you see, you can throw all your gear in the back of them and go and do a gig. And you don't have to rent a van. So it's like I was getting jobs that were based around the band, you know.
Yeah.
But we all had the jobs to pay off. The good thing about it was that we were working as not like 8:30 till 4 in the day or 7:30 till 5 or whatever hours we had, earning money. And then from we would go home and have something to eat, and then 6:30, 7 o'clock till maybe midnight, we'd be down at this old spoon factory rehearsing. And we had an income of maybe $250 a week between us, which would pay for...
Total?
Yeah, total.
All of the members of the band, you got about $250 a week?
Yeah, I was on £16-17 a week when I started at Osborne's, which is about $30 a week.
Oh,
it did go up. It did get higher the older you got. But it wasn't much more. Maybe $300 a week, which you would pay for your board and your cigarettes and your booze, and pay off your 10 quid a week for a guitar or a PA or whatever we bought. We'd be down there till midnight, and then we'd have no money, so we'd be walking home in midwinter, 7 or 8 miles, and then getting up at 7:30 to go to work. I mean, it's every band that's ever made it has done that. It's no big deal, that's part of the thing that you have to go. That's your apprenticeship. That makes you appreciate what's happening now, is remembering what it was like.
True, yeah,
you always have this affection for it because you know that you'll never go back to that.
The debut of MTV with 24 hours of music videos occurred between Def Leppard's second album, High and Dry, and their third release, Pyromania. So I asked Def Leppard bass player Rick Savage how a full-time U.S. video channel affected the setup for the release of Pyromania in February 1983.
I think in a huge way, in fairness. I think MTV, they were actually just becoming popular around about the same time as we were, and it ended up being like a mutual thing, in fairness. They were great for us, and I think looking back, we were great for them. They started playing Bringing On The Heartbreak from the High and Dry album, and it set up the release of the Pyromania album so well that because it was like a preempt, and everybody was like, all of a sudden the name was around, MTV was getting more and more popular in its own right. And then it just gave us that little launching pad for when Photograph came out, that it just made it so much easier to actually, get the band across to everybody in America. And obviously it has to dovetail with the radio as well. And the two things just seemed to slot into place.
When did you realize that you were becoming video stars, and in Joe in particular, a sex symbol in America?
One thing, we never enjoy making videos. It's always a pain in the arse. It really is. It's time-consuming. It's very tedious. It's more tedious than making some of our previous records. And because of that, it's great to actually know that you're getting played and to sometimes actually see yourself on TV. I don't think you ever lose the thrill of that, no matter who you are. But I think that's as far as it goes. We're pretty down-to-earth people, and we really don't take each other that seriously. Honestly, I mean, I know maybe everybody can say this, but we never, ever... I mean, it's hideous, actually, just the thought of it. It's like, it's great getting the exposure, and I think maybe we probably looked upon it more in a business sense than than in some sort of egotistical way.
Def Leppard's Action, Not Words, from their third breakthrough album, Pyromania. Coming up next, Joe Elliott, Phil Collin, and Rick Savage reveal the importance of their producer in maximizing the Def Leppard sound and huge commercial success. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio with the guys from Def Leppard.
Welcome back to In the Studio for Pyromania. I'm Joe Elliott of Def Leppard.
I'm Phil Collin of Def Leppard.
And Rick Savage, and we're from Def Leppard, and we're in the studio.
For Pyromania.
And I'm Redbeard. Pyromania, which Rolling Stone magazine ranks at number 384 on their top 500 albums of all time. Halfway through the recording, guitarist Pete Willis was fired due to problems with alcohol. Londoner Phil Collin was his immediate replacement. Producer Mutt Lange, who was rapidly building a superb reputation after doing AC/DC's Back in Black and Foreigner 4, to his credit, Mutt made certain that the transition was seamless. Here's Joe Elliott and Phil Collin of Def Leppard.
He knew that we were then restless and very impatient, And he knew that there was a certain energy that he wanted to capture of this young, energetic, fast, hard-rocking
right.
band. Uh-huh. But at the same time, he wanted to take us one stage further than Tom had done. So there's like this compromise going off that neither of us knew about. It's like he'd be kind of trying to lean us in one direction, but trying to not lose the energy by not making us keep doing it over and over again to get perfection. So it's like he'd compromise himself a little bit, standard-wise, and we were compromising ourselves energy-wise, and we ended up with this very energetic, but pretty much better than the first album.
High and Dry. High and Dry record. Definitely was a step forward.
And then by the time we'd finished touring and got back together and wrote the songs for Pyromania, with Mutt there in the room this time, while we were piecing the album together, which is why he got writing credits on the last two albums, is when we were doing pre-production for High and Dry, we had the songs and we just turned up with them and we did them, and little changes that got made didn't warrant any major credits or anything. And everybody's quite happy with that. But with Pyromania, it was basically six people sat around in a circle facing each other, bouncing ideas off. So it was like we'd sat down and said, listen, On Through the Night had done so many copies and been reasonably successful. High and Dry was a much better album and was slightly better. This is the third album, which is, you know, in a lot of bands' cases, is the major album. And it's kind of make or break album. So we decided we'd really go to town and try and make the ultimate rock album. So we put a lot more effort and energy into not the recording of the record, but into the actual songs. So once we knew the songs were great
and the arranging
and the arrangements were perfect and the lyrics and the hooks were there, then it was a case of just putting it together, which is why we then, at that stage of our careers, could understand a little bit more Mutt's way of thinking of, like, doesn't matter how you get there, as long as you get there in the end, we've got this song, let's do whatever we have to get the thing perfect, or as near as our version of perfect, which we did to a certain extent with Pyromania.
You got me. Def Leppard from the Pyromania album with Coming Under Fire. Singer Joe Elliott felt the addition of Phil Collin with his own musical influences simply strengthened Def Leppard. Here's Joe talking with and about Phil.
There's a lot of snobbery in musicianship where you'll get certain people won't listen to up-and-coming bands because they automatically think, oh, we're better than them, so I won't bother listening to them. Instead of always constantly looking up to the guy you learnt off, like, say, Richie Blackmore's and your Jeff Beck's of the world or your Eric Clapton's, and continuously staying behind, he's doing the same thing to the younger guys as well. And that is another major contributing factor into keeping the band always fresh, because what you can end up doing is you develop a style, which eventually is your own. I mean, anybody's first album is a
derivative,
conglomeration
sure.
of everything you've listened to for 20 years.
It's impossible not to.
Then you develop your own style, and the mistake that a lot of bands make, i.e. say Uriah Heep in the 70s, is they stick to this style all the way through and it never changes.
They clone themselves and then it starts sounding like that, and then it starts sounding dated. So, I mean, if you stay one step ahead of that, the worst crime a band could do is sound dated.
Yeah.
You know? And it only sounds like that if you're not fresh and enthusiastic. So, yeah, you can play kind of old-fashioned type music, you know, whatever you want to call it. But if you've got conviction and everything, it still sounds cool. We're not a rock band who contrives a pop song or a pop band that contrives a rock sound. It's just anything that sounds good to us. So, you know, I think there's a difference there with some bands. They're a rock band and they get this pop song. It's not really them, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it'll stand out as the one track out of 10 that's not them.
Right.
Or whatever. With us, we've always tried to go for variety.
Yeah, but it's a natural thing. You know, a lot of the bands in England were just too far into the heavy metal type thing and there wasn't a lot of songs going off. And that's the great thing about Def Leppard, you know, there's songs. You can actually sit there and sing them as well.
Looking back to Pyromania, Def Leppard's Rick Savage and Joe Elliott note that the band collectively was developing an image without any one member pushing or being pushed to the forefront.
When we're not making albums and we're not doing what we do as musicians, we keep a very low profile. There's no real celebrities in the band. There never really has been.
Okay.
And I think that the celebrity thing can somehow, whether it's a character or personality of individuals. You see, when you mentioned that about the video thing, I instantly thought Van Halen. Now, they were video stars to me because they were larger than life always. Diamond Dave was Diamond Dave, you know. And he had the character that entertained me. And it was almost like video for a band like Van Halen at that time was tailor-made. They were made for each other. I always got the impression with us, with all due respect to all of us, that it was something that promoted the album rather than promoted us as characters or personalities as such, you know, okay. Because we're actually very normal, down-to-earth people.
For the long term, is there some care that must be observed when using video? Can it have a boomerang effect? And what can be done once a video to a song is released and the song turns out to be a huge hit? How do you control the genie after it's out of the bottle?
Well, you can't. The one thing about videos, they can make or break you. I think going back further than that, photograph the video, I think people that are fans of the band will forever associate the Union Jack t-shirt with that song.
Yep.
So it can be tied together. The downside of it is, unfortunately, something like, I mean, God bless him, because he was very generous to us, but the very sad Billy Squire video of the poor guy squirming around on the floor in pink bedsheets, silk bedsheets, and I think it killed his career.
I honestly think that
video destroyed Billy Squire.
It did.
Empty bed is a night alone. I read out loud.
That's another of the reasons why Def Leppard has sold more than 10 million copies of Pyromania. No fooling. When we come back, Def Leppard's Phil Collin, Joe Elliott, and Rick Savage explain how that level of success brought a new awareness of great expectations. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio for the anniversary of Def Leppard's Pyromania.
Welcome back to In the Studio for Pyromania. I'm Joe Elliott of Def Leppard.
I'm Phil Collin of Def Leppard.
And Rick Savage, and we're from Def Leppard, and we're in the studio
for Pyromania.
And I'm Redbeard. Welcome back. No one in Def Leppard was more than 23 years old when Pyromania was released in 1983. Drummer Rick Allen was only 19. It was an enormous accomplishment for such a young band, and frankly, a lot of pressure. Joe Elliott and Phil Collin in the studio.
We're very reluctant to spend big bucks on a video, especially nowadays when it won't get played anyway. But we've always much rather spent that extra money on the songs in the studio because, you know, I think that if and when anything of Def Leppard gets sent out in a space capsule, it's not going to be one of our videos, it's going to be one of our songs. And I think when you put more emphasis on the video than the song, then you're in it for all the wrong reasons. We all like to pose and pretend to be Mark Bolan, and we may all got in, you know, may have all got involved in music because of what we'd seen as a 12-year-old on Top of the Pops. But you don't get to see it unless there's something to hear. You know, the song came before the public performance. And that's always going to be the most important thing for us.
But what was Mark Bolan wearing on his feet? What kind of shoes did he have on?
Same type of shoes that Joe's probably still got in his wardrobe, actually.
Yeah, women's shoes. I always wear women's shoes. You know that red beard.
Probably silver with a big star on the instep.
I'll never forget
and
that.
And a feather boa as well.
I'll never forget
yeah,
that.
I mean, him and Bowie, man, they were very androgynous in those days, and you got away with it, you know. It was all mascara, feather boas, and women's shoes, and satin trousers. And I don't know, as a 12-year-old guy from a steel town, somehow I kind of got a kick out of it all. I'll probably become a cross-dresser in my 50s, who knows. Kontakt, lieben, glauben, globen.
We'll be right back.
There were times during the recording of Pyromania when the members of Def Leppard weren't sure they could live up to Mutt Lange's expectations. Joe Elliott and Phil Collin remember.
About halfway through the Pyromania album, I first noticed that it was getting difficult to create something that was as good as the top-notch artists. We weren't that little band from Sheffield anymore. We had to be better and bigger than Boston, Foreigner, Led Zeppelin, you name them. And you, all of a sudden you say, okay, then if I've got to be that, if I want to be that big, and it's going to be, that's the way I want my life to be, you know, you have to forsake a lot of things.
You know, your social life goes out the window totally. And girlfriends and just stuff like that, that are just regular standard things, become really difficult to
forget
keep
it,
up.
You know?
So you have to kind of make a choice, really. You have to go in that direction if you want to achieve success, really.
Now, that doesn't sound too glamorous.
Well,
you know?
there is a slight myth. You know, I don't want to put it down.
It does have its
glamorous sides, but there's a lot of bull that goes along with it, you know. But as Phil says, you make that decision when you start off. If you want to be successful, I was really having a bad time trying to sing a song. I can't even remember which one it was now. I mean, that's how insignificant it's become.
Right.
But at the time, it was a major headache. And we didn't have a row, but I just said, listen, I can't do it. And he said, well, okay, you can take that defeatist attitude if you want, but if you want to be one of the big boys, you should just sit down, think about it, come back and try again. You want to be better and bigger than Lou Gramm. You want to be better than Robert Plant. You want to be up there with the big boys. You got to work it. You got to say, yes, I can do it, no matter how long it takes you. Lo and behold, the next day I went in and did it twice as good as I thought I could.
I've noticed that. Guitar things, it used to make me do things that I couldn't physically do. And it'd just sit you there and you'd get it, you know. Amazing guy.
He really is like the most easygoing slave driver.
A great way to put it.
You could ever meet, you know. He very rarely loses his temper. He'll never lose his temper with it. The only time Mutt will ever lose his temper if we lose it first. Then he'll have a go back. But he'll never turn around and say, oh, this is stupid, you've been doing it for too long. He'll just keep going until you get it, you know. He'll suggest, let's just take a break. And we'll, you know, to the extent sometimes you just get in the car and drive to the other side of the country just to go and look at a tree. He's big time into gardening now. He loves his gardening, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then you'll come back and in 20 minutes you'll nail what you've been trying to do for 3 hours before
wow.
it, you know. Yeah. It's just that time away from it helps. And he knows exactly when to bring that in. We don't have any rules. There's no rules. It's just that we just go in there and you kind of, it's like the blind leading the blind, but they really know where they're going because they've got this inbuilt radar.
It all paid tremendous dividends, with the Pyromania album selling more than 10 million copies just in the U.S. There would be more obstacles to overcome, of course, including the auto accident that cost drummer Rick Allen his left arm. And guitarist Steve Clark would later die in January 1991 after a lengthy battle with alcoholism that would force his departure from Def Leppard. Rock and roll isn't always bright lights and good times. Here's Rick Savage.
I think at the time you don't really look into it that deeply. I think that's the thing.
No.
You're so into what you're doing and you believe in it. And we've always believed in every song that we've done, even up to present day. But I think when there's a certain naivety involved, and I think that's nice because it's not a premeditated thing at all, and it is a natural thing. It happened. We actually kicked a lot of bands in the head in the late 70s, certainly the early 80s. You know, that were good bands and valid bands. You know, you talk about your Journeys and your Foreigners and your Styxes. Great bands, they really were. But all of a sudden, these new bands that were young and fresh and had a slightly different attitude came along. We were one of those bands. And that's how it got. And I think that's how it should be. You know, it's no criticism of established groups at all. It's that people are always wanting something fresh. And it does create the wheel that Joe was talking about.
Yeah, it's true. We were trying to pin the tail on a donkey when there was no donkey there to pin the tail on. You know, it's between ourselves and Mutt, we just had this game plan. With his enthusiasm and knowledge and our inexperience and enthusiasm and, you know, that youthful exuberance that we had, and in fact, even still now have, because if there's any one industry in the world that keeps you young, it's this one.
Amen.
We basically just attacked it. Like, we just sat down and said, let's try and make a record that nobody else has ever made. And we said the same thing with Pyromania. We said it again with Hysteria, because after 6 million or so copies of Pyromania in America, you can imagine that you as a young band, you get this paranoia, which is fed to you partly by the media, that everybody's got their knives out ready to stab you in the back and tear you to shreds with your next release. And it was our job to go in the studio for the next album and make sure that they couldn't do that. And that's basically what we tried to do with Hysteria. And, you know, obviously with hindsight, we succeeded.
Somewhere in the distance, I hear the bells ring. Darkness settles on the town as the children start to sing. And the lady across the street, she shuts out the night. I guess the thousands waiting as she turns out the light. But it's too late, too late.
Love from Def Leppard's Pyromania album, which set new standards for commercial success and defined the predominant sound of hard rock in the 80s. I'm Redbeard, back in the studio after this.